Welcome to the Human Life International's 15th World Conference on Love, Life, and the Family, held April 10th through the 14th, 1996, in Cincinnati, Ohio. We now join this program live at the Omni Netherland Hotel.
View Dr. Alice von Hildebrand. Dr. von Hildebrand has written many books. She is a professor, a philosopher. She has a tremendous teaching career behind her, Hunter College. She was an assistant professor. And she, of course, has much to teach us today. I hope many of you were at her talk yesterday. We're going to be shortening this particular talk this morning because right after this talk, we have to set up this room for the luncheon with Congressman Chris Smith. So this talk will end precisely at 12, maybe a few minutes before. So there will be no questions. If you have questions, don't worry, write them down, and during Dr. von Hildebrand's next talk, you can address those questions at that time to hear. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce you, Dr. Alice von Hildebrand.
Reverend Fathers, dear friends of life, not so long ago, I had dinner with three priests, and triggered by female curiosity, I said to them, Reverend Fathers, you've heard thousands of confessions in your life. Has any penitent ever accused himself of the sin of irreverence? There was a moment of silence, and then all three priests said in unison, no, never. This is rather surprising because irreverence is a sin that we commit daily. And what is strange is that we do not even notice it because it does not necessarily manifest itself in actions, but what it does do is to ruin our attitude towards the world, towards God, and towards other people. Reverence plays an absolutely crucial role in our moral and religious life. But if you read Catholic textbooks on moral theology, you're going to see that the emphasis is usually put on the four cardinal virtues: justice, temperance, prudence, and fortitude. Very little is said about reverence. And the gist of my talk is trying to show to you that this virtue is so crucial that Christian life and our moral life depends upon it. It's no doubt one of the great merits of my late husband that in most of his books he has highlighted the importance of reverence in man's life. As a matter of fact, in The Art of Living, he says, quote, reverence is the mother of all virtues, unquote. But you're going to be surprised if in this talk, which is largely based on my husband's philosophy, I'm going to quote a lot of Plato. Plato, who was a Greek and was a pagan. When you read his works carefully, you're going to see that always again, he stresses the crucial importance of reverence. Speaking about the heyday of Athens, before Athens became decadent in the 4th century, he said, at that time, reverence was our queen and mistress, implying that it was no longer the case in the 4th century, and for this reason, Athens was decadent. He says that politicians and educators should stress again and again the crucial role of reverence. He says you should implant into the child a deep reverence for antiquity, meaning to say the importance of tradition. Plato has seen so keenly that to abandon tradition is going to have tremendously serious consequences for our moral and religious life. The very moment that you look down on the past because you believe that you know better, you fall into the danger of hubris. And hubris leads to moral decadence, meaning to say, now I'm mature, now I know better, nor I no longer need any guidance. Any parents will tell you that when a child declares himself to be mature, he's starting the crisis of puberty. Now, Plato says further, parents should not bequeath their children any money. They should bequeath their children a spirit of reverence. Now, obviously, there's a difficulty. You can bequeath money to your children, but you cannot bequeath in your will the spirit of reverence. Money can ruin them. Reverence can save them. But this is something that you cannot give to another person. This is something that each person has to conquer individually. And we know as Christians that we need God's grace. Speaking about the gods, and Plato oscillates from speaking of the gods or God, he says, when I mention their names, I have a feeling of awe which is such that it above any other feeling of holy fear. Plato speaking about the gods. He says in the society, the ideal society that we're trying to build up, we'll never allow anybody to make the gods responsible for what is evil. One of the basic principles of our society has to be that the gods are responsible for what is good. What is evil is man's made. This is what I call reverence. He says that when children treat their parents with reverence, particularly when they are old, they are pleasing to God, and God will hear their prayers. Now, the society in which we live is a society affected by a cancer that has penetrated so far that if it were not for God's grace, we seem to be morally doomed. And what is our main sin? Irreverence. Let us not forget that man is a creature. And a creature is a being totally dependent upon God for his existence and his life. Which one of us can keep ourselves in existence for a single minute? Which one of us has a guarantee that tonight we'll still be alive, or 5 minutes from now? This is all in God's hand. Therefore, I claim that humility and reverence are virtues that are particularly becoming to creatures. And we are creatures. Plato calls us a creature of a day. We step on the human stage, and before we know it, we are gone. In the book of Sirach, it is said, how can he who is dust and ashes be brought? And this is what man is. Now, therefore, you see, irreverence is a sin which is so serious because it truly militates the very nature of man, who is subject to God, and that is man's glory. Man has no greater glory than to be God's servant. This is why it is said in the liturgy, to serve God is to reign. But since original sin, man has become a rebel. And time and again, this rebellion emerges and has dreadful consequences. And one of the signs of this rebellion today is the hybris that has seized modern man because of his fantastic, mind-boggling accomplishments in the course of the last 50 years. You know, the world in which we live today is no longer the world in which I was born, in which there was no television, no supersonic plane, no computer, and so forth and so on. And you will notice that once we have found a key to technological advances, it proceeds further and further and further, and it's almost scary. So modern man is convinced that he's now the master of the universe, the master of his life, that he's to decide what he's to do and not do. He's going to decide what is good and what is evil. Now, man cannot create himself, but he has a power to destroy. You see, even when a husband embraces his wife, there's absolutely no guarantee that there'll be a conception, unless God wills it. But what man can do is to destroy. And that is the abomination of abortion. It is man's rebellious revolt against God. I cannot create, but I can destroy. That is my power. the fool in Rome who years ago injured, or, you know, the statue of Michelangelo that had taken years to be built, and in 2 minutes he had harmed it severely. It was an act of rebellion. I cannot be a Michelangelo, but I can destroy what Michelangelo did. When the atomic bomb was created, invented, I recall saying to myself, man cannot say fiat, be it, and the world was, but he can say non-fiat, and the world can be destroyed. And this is a power that we have today, and this has gone to man's head. We believe that we are masters. We believe that now we no longer keep guidance. We know best. And this leads to a disease which is so widespread, but people don't know that they have it. Once again, let me rely on my husband's thought. This disease is moral blindness. And St. Augustine says, moral blindness is a punishment for sin. You sin, and you sin, and you sin again, and one very fine day, you no longer see that it is a sin. You believe that you are particularly keen-sighted. In this country, we are blessed with a president and a first lady as blind as bats. And what about the superior, the Supreme Court? What about our judges? All these people who decide that in order to be free, man has to decide himself what is good and what is evil. You know, this is a punishment for sin, because when these people say, I see no harm in killing babies, even though they're half born, he is blind. This is why he can say so with a smile on his lips and a sort of feeling that he's truly seeking the good of the country. You know, this is a situation that we are facing today. Now, what is the cause of this moral blindness, which is a tremendous curse? When a person is physically blind, he knows that he's blind. He knows that he has a handicap. He knows that he needs help. The amazing thing about moral blindness is people haven't got the faintest idea that they no longer see. And I mean, whether it is abortion or euthanasia, all the horrors taking place in our society, the people defending these horrors, these people claim that they see, and we are the ones that are blind and do not see that this is perfectly legitimate, because modern man has advanced so much that now he can discern by himself what is good and what is evil. My husband says in his book, The Art of Living, that there are two main sources of irreverence. I'm going to speak about this very rapidly because of lack of time, and one of them is pride, that you believe that you know better, that you believe that you are superior, that you believe you don't need guidance, you believe that you know everything best. And then obviously, why listen to the Bible, that after all is a very, very old book, you know. Things have changed in the meantime. Don't forget that we have progressed, even though if progress means to move towards an abyss, because when you walk toward an abyss, you are progressing, but obviously the end is going to be catastrophic. The other source of irreverence, my husband says, is concupiscence, that people are so absorbed in pleasure and satisfaction and their cravings that they become totally blind. Their eyes are so bloated that all that they see is, this is pleasant and I have a right to have it, this is unpleasant and I have a right to avoid it at all costs. Unfortunately, since Vatican II, irreverence has penetrated into our churches. How many people no longer genuflect in front of the Blessed Sacrament? How many people go to church as it was a place of meeting when you can chat with your friends, even in front of the Blessed Sacrament? How many people go to church dressed in a fashion which is shameful? How dare you go to church in shorts? I know people going to early mass in the morning in jogging clothes, because, I mean, one thing on their program is to jog, and the next thing is to go to church, and then to jog again. You see, no, these are signs of irreverence. And this is a cancer which is ruining our religious life. It seems to me that we have lost sight of the teaching of Saint Benedict, who says man is made of body and soul, and man's bodily posture, man's attitude towards his body is going to have a profound influence on his soul. Therefore, when you cross your legs, or you yawn in church, or you dress in a way which is simply immodest, this is going to affect your religious life. Have no illusion about it. Everything that we do in our bodily fashion is going to have an influence on the soul, very much as the soul has an influence on the body. Chesterton was the one who remarked so profoundly, "Today people forget how tall they are on their knees." You see, a creature belongs on his knees because a creature's great mission is to adore. And you adore best when you are on your knees. You know, sometimes in television, you see Muslim ceremonies. And you see all these people bowing. Now, Christ is not present in their churches, in their mosques. But, I mean, they certainly teach us reverence. How can Muslim entering a Catholic church and seeing that even priests crack jokes right in front of the Blessed Sacrament, how can they believe that we believe that Christ is present? It's absolutely impossible. You see, one of the new things which has penetrated into churches is that priests believe that in order to win the public, they have to crack jokes, and therefore that somehow the service is going to be very, very successful if people have been brought to laughter. Now, I personally do not go to church to laugh, even though I love jokes, I love humor, and I love laughter. I go to church to adore and to be receptive to God's message. And therefore, I don't need jokes. Chesterton said the 18th century called himself the age of reason. Whether they were right is something that I don't discuss. The 19th century called itself the age of common sense. It says the only thing that can be said about the 20th century is that it is the age of uncommon nonsense. And I'm very much afraid that he is right, because we major in irreverence. I'm just going to give you a sample of how irreverent our society has become. Most of you might know Monsignor Wren, famous for his work in catechesis. Some time ago, he was hospitalized in New York City. He was lying in bed, and all of a sudden, a woman in jeans and a sweatshirt comes in and says, Hi, buddy, take your butt out of that bed. Now, when a Monsignor is addressed, so you can imagine that he is in a state of shock. And then he turned to the woman and said, "Who are you?" He says, "Oh, I'm a therapist." He says, "What you need is speech therapy." Now, my talk is mostly centered on an extremely sensitive topic, one which is difficult to handle, and I almost ask for your prayers to perform well, because it's a very, very sensitive topic, namely authority. Now, I claim that irreverence has succeeded in sapping authority in the church, in the family, and in our lives in general. When there is irreverence, there is no more respect for authority. I do not know if we realize enough the blessing that authority is in man's life. You know, after all, let me repeat, man is a creature. Man is a being who is liable to make mistakes. Which one of us would dare stand up and say, "I always was right"? We make mistakes, intellectual mistakes. We fall into all sorts of errors. We need authority to be guided to God. And this authority is granted to us through the Holy Roman Catholic Church. "Thou art Peter, and on this rock I shall build my church." This is why the Catholic Church is one. And this is why, if you study the history of Protestantism that started in the 16th century, after four centuries, Protestants have developed into 27,000 sects, because they have no authority. There's no one saying to you, "This is good and this is evil. This is true and this is false." Therefore, I claim this is one of tremendous blessings that we have, and simultaneously a blessing that we do not appreciate. When Christ spoke to Pilate, and Pilate said to him, "Don't you realize that I have the authority to keep your life or to kill you?" Christ answered, "You'll have no authority it had not been given to you by God. So it is said very clearly that authority comes from God. And I mean by authority that a person has a right to command or to order certain things quite independently of whether the person has agreed to obey or not. You see, when the Pope tells me this is true, and he says so ex cathedra, he didn't ask me, do you like this or not? He simply says, so it is. And he's speaking in the name of God. He's not speaking in his own name. Now, therefore, we've got to realize there's a tremendous distinction that we have to make. People keep forgetting between a person's office and a person as individual person. The Pope, the cardinals, the bishops, the priests have received authority. Does it mean that the Pope or the cardinal or the bishop or the priest are necessarily saints or holy? No. Chesterton says very wittily, as he always does, we obey the colonel, not because he's the best man, but because he's the colonel, period. So you don't say to the colonel, before I will obey you, please give me your credential. How did you do in high school? What is your record? Give me your curriculum vitae, and then I'll decide whether or not I will obey you. He's a colonel. You better obey. Otherwise, you'll pay the consequences. And he says, still more wittily, he says, you know how stupid it would be if you say, the colonel is quite witty. No, the major is quite witty. But obviously, the colonel is wittier because he's a colonel. No, this is, of course, nonsensical. The fact that you're in authority has nothing to do with your individual person. Read the epistles of St. Paul. He starts always again, Paul speaking, using the authority that God has given him. He's not speaking in his own name. He's not speaking because he's a Jewish tent maker. He's speaking because he's an apostle of Christ. Now, I claim that it is so important to distinguish between the two, because quite independently of who the individual bishop might be as a person, his office is to be respected. And this is what is no longer done today. If you recall the way that the Pope was treated in Nicaragua or Holland, it gives you an idea of the tremendous irreverence that is shown to the Pope's office. St. Paul says in his epistle to Timothy, he says, let no one despise your youth. Timothy was a bishop, and he was very young. And St. Paul says, let us not, don't allow people to despise you because you are young, which is an individual characteristic, and therefore despise your office, which must be respected because it comes from God. Now, if you read the Old and New Testament, they're going to see that God never promised to give us perfect leaders, outstandingly intelligent or holy. We've had some, and we have to be grateful for them, but he never said, I promise that I'm going to give you the most intelligent, the most talented, the most reliable, the holier people as leaders. But he did say, the gates of hell shall not prevail. That he did promise. Now, God's ways are not always. God makes choices that we, stupid human beings, would not make. When he wanted the Jewish people to be liberated from Egypt, whom did he choose? Moses. And Moses says, but, oh God, I have a speech defect. Now, who is mad enough to send as herald to the Pharaoh, the most important man in the world, someone who stuttered? Just imagine you go to the Pharaoh and you say, I would like the people of, and so on. It's ridiculous. And God says, you go, and he obeys. He chooses David as king of Israel. The man became an adulterer and a murderer. And nevertheless, God knew it, and he chose him, and then he converted and wrote the magnificent 50th Psalm that we should pray every single day. He chooses Peter as head of his church. Peter, who said at the Last Supper, when everybody will abandon you, O Lord, I will follow you. I'll die for you. He was honest. But 3 hours afterwards, because he was scared of a maid, not of the high priest, of a maid who said, are you not one of them? He says, I do not know that man. Now, once again, this is Peter as man, and then there is Peter as Pope. You know that in the 19th century, Napoleon dominated Europe. And then what happened was that Napoleon understood that in order to complete his conquest, he had to dominate the church. And so he had the brilliant idea of imprisoning the Pope, bringing him to France, and intimidating for months on end. And when he thought the Pope had been sufficiently intimidated, he came to him and he gave him a concordat. And this concordat basically was selling the Roman Catholic Church to Napoleon. The Secretary of State, called Consalvi, read the concordat and went to His Holiness, Pius VII, and said, "Your Holiness, you may not sign this concordat. It is selling the church in the hands of Napoleon." So when Napoleon came back the next day and said, "Give me the concordat signed," Consalvi said, "Your Majesty, the concordat is not signed." And then Napoleon went into tantrums and started screaming and shouting and said, "If you don't sign that concordat, I will destroy the Roman Catholic Church." Consalvi answered very calmly, "Your Majesty, if popes and cardinals and bishops and priests have not succeeded in destroying the church in 1900 years, how do you expect to do so in your lifetime?" Now the question is that today you hear lots of complaints about our bishops. And I raise a daring question, and it's a daring talk. Can a fervent, believing Roman Catholic criticize his bishop? I went to Rome, and I raised the question to 5 cardinals, because today, being a woman, I have access to all the cardinals that I want. That is one of the great victories of feminism. And all 5 answered identically, "Yes, you can criticize bishops, but respectfully." And I would like to add, regretfully, because there's nothing sadder for a Roman Catholic to see that his shepherd is not living up to the teaching of the church. Now, if you enjoy criticizing, if you eagerly look forward to your next criticism and say, "Haha, I'm going to catch him again. I knew that he was going to falter," don't do it. Only do it if you're reverent and you regret that you have to do it. Now, this is a very difficult position, extremely difficult, because you have to combine 2 things: firmness in opposing abuses and simultaneously respect for the office of the person who is allowing these abuses. Don't forget, they have authority over us. And now I would like to make a short meditation on the difficulty of being a bishop. Only mad, raving feminists can crave for the dignity of being bishops today. They must be totally out of their minds, because it's not an easy job. And it seems to me that if you accept it, you have to accept it in fear and trembling, because the bishops are exposed to extremely, very many severe temptations. One of them is the spirit of the time. And the spirit of the time is secularism, to adapt the church to the modern world, to make the church acceptable to the modern world, so that the modern world would say, you know, the church used to be so awful, but today she's truly moving forward, she's improving, and therefore she becomes acceptable to the secularistic mentality. Now, let us not forget that it was Pius X who said, "We must try to convert the church to the church, excuse the world to the church, not vice versa, and adapt the church to the spirit of the world." After all, Christ said, "I am not praying